This episode is brought to you by EY. How can EY teams help you create a better version of your company? We work with you to turn data into greater insights, invest to drive growth, and realize your strategic vision through thoughtful implementation. Visit ey.com/reimagine to learn more.
Intel is the spark for the dreamers who do. They dream of a life with no diseases, of cleaner, greener, more reliable energy, of advancing education, by bringing AI everywhere. Intel is the spark to start something new, to know that no dream is too daring when you have the right foundation. It starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
You know success when you see it, or you think you do, the people in the spotlight. But what about those small business masterminds who succeed at making their money work harder? They do that by having a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, which now earns 5% annual percentage yield. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. I'm Carol Masser.
And I'm Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stenovec. We're here every day bringing you the latest news from the world of business and finance.
Plus technology, politics, economics, all harnessing the power of Business Week reporters and editors.
Not to mention our 2,700 journalists and analysts in more than 120 countries.
You can download Bloomberg Business Week on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
You can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern Time on Bloomberg Radio.
Or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News.
There is a new top lieutenant in town at Meta. I don't know if you've noticed. We got to find out who it is and what it means for the company. This is a story by Bloomberg News technology reporter Kurt Wagner writing about it for Bloomberg Business Week, which is online at Bloomberg.com/businessweek, also on the Bloomberg Terminal. So let's get the story from Bloomberg News big tech team leader, Sarah Friar. She joins us on the phone in San Francisco. Sarah, by the way, author of No Filter, The Inside Story of Instagram. It's a great story for a summer read. All right, Sarah, so who is this new top lieutenant that we need to know about?
He is the most important person at Facebook you've never heard of. If you've heard of him at all, actually, it might be from the documents that came out of congressional investigations, or perhaps the data leak by Francis Haugen, the whistleblower, the Facebook whistleblower. And that's because Javier Olivan, he's been involved in everything, every big strategic move. He was the head of growth. So all of the big acquisitions that mattered, the WhatsApp acquisition for $22 billion in 2014, the Onavo acquisition, which is another very important acquisition that allowed Facebook to track how competitors' apps were being used by people on their mobile phones, like a really good tool for crushing the competition. All of that has come to light in the antitrust hearings. Javier Olivan is essentially Mark Zuckerberg's favorite fixer of big problems. And the biggest problem that always seems to matter to Zuckerberg the most is growth. Mm. And so now he needs to come on, as Kurt writes, and fix the business as COO, the role vacated by Sheryl Sandberg.
So as Mark Zuckerberg's favorite fixer, what do you think is number one on his priority list to fix right now?
It's really about the business model. Look, Meta had its first quarter of revenue decline ever as a public company in this most recent quarter, and they have to figure out how to get the advertising business back on track. But they also have to figure out how to make money off of this pie in the sky vision for the metaverse, which may or may not happen, but it's where Zuckerberg is pointing a lot of the talent at Facebook, a lot of the investment at Facebook. He really needs the metaverse to work because that's the future. The platform that Mr. Olivan worked so hard to build to incredible prominence around the world, now it has more than half of the world's internet connection population. There's really just not that much farther to grow, and it's not like Facebook can buy its way to more growth because of all the antitrust pressure. So that's why they have to build out the metaverse. And they have not figured out how they're going to make money off of it. They haven't figured out how they're going to get people to want to use it. So there's a lot of big questions looming for Meta. Meanwhile, the stock has lost more than half its value, and it's just a critical time for the company.
So, Sarah, can we equate him to someone else at either who took over either at Microsoft or at Google, like, you know, or even Apple? I feel like we didn't really know a ton about Tim Cook, you know, for a long, and all of a sudden, you know, he's obviously been very key to what's been going on in the company as the CEO now. But I mean, is there somebody else in Silicon Valley that we can liken this guy to?
I think maybe the most similar to Sundar Pichai, and I say that only because he's very much a data guy. He grew up in Facebook's engineering culture, and a lot of the decisions that he has put into motion have come from understanding how people are using Facebook's products and using competitors' products, and how they should adjust their behavior to fit to that. And the other reason that I compare him to Sundar is just because of his international background. Mm-hmm. As a person from Spain, who speaks many languages, by the way, not just Spanish, he has a sense of how people use Facebook's products, or don't use them for that matter, around the rest of the world. And he's really been key at pushing the company into broader thinking about how to build, in places with low data, where people have to purchase their data, unlike in the U.S., by the minute or by the bit. So I think that he has pushed things like WhatsApp in part because of his personal experience talking to family internationally, understanding how people, live in non-Facebook centric worlds.
And Sarah, like you already said, we don't know much. We don't see him a lot, Olivan. And in the story, Kurt writes that Olivan rarely speaks publicly or posts to Facebook or Instagram, but he's had a hand in all of Facebook's major competitive battles and acquisitions. What has been his biggest stamp on the company thus far?
People always ask me, they don't think that Facebook's a very innovative company. Like, what has Facebook actually built? Like, they bought Instagram, they bought WhatsApp, they copy Snapchat, they copy TikTok. What have they actually built? And my answer is their growth strategy. That is the thing that has been innovative about Facebook, this grow at all cost strategy that really Javier Olivan is the brainchild behind. Like, he's the person who pushed a lot of this, aggressive methods for making sure that people join Facebook and join Facebook as an alternative to competitors, and make sure that if anything's ever broken in the app that prevents people from staying there or spending more time there, that they fix it quickly. And all of that mechanism of push notifications and getting people to really become so attached to these products, all those little moves add up. And they all come from this growth team that he led for so long.
But on his agenda is growth, right? He doesn't have to deal with maybe the Washington stuff, the policy stuff. It's all about making sure this company grows. Just got about 25 seconds left.
Right, and that's been the problem too, right? He has built this company to the point where it has these incredible blind spots because of its size, and maybe didn't think about those things while growing.
Yeah, it's a really good point. Hey, Sarah, thank you so much. Sarah Fryer, she's Big Tech Team Leader at Bloomberg News. Check out her book, No Filter, The Inside Story of Instagram. This story written by Bloomberg News technology reporter Kurt Wagner from Bloomberg Businessweek, which you can find online on the Bloomberg Terminal. So be sure to check it out.
You're listening to Bloomberg Businessweek with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
Well, on the Bloomberg today is a story about how Ether is surging in anticipation of a groundbreaking software upgrade to its blockchain. This is something you've been following, right? Like all that's going on?
Yeah. It's interesting. So Ether, the Ethereum blockchain is the second most popular blockchain, second, of course, to Bitcoin. And the token attached to the Ethereum blockchain, Ether, has absolutely been on fire since about mid-June because everyone's waiting for the merge, the long-awaited merge, basically moving from proof-of-work mining which is very, very energy intensive.
Right.
You've heard a lot of that criticism centered around Bitcoin, moving from proof of work to proof of stake, which would require a lot less energy.
Okay. So this is a big deal, bottom line.
It's a big deal.
This is why we talked to Katie, because she understands this stuff. All right. So in our weekly crypto segment, Natalie Brunell is a journalist, podcaster, adjunct professor of advanced communication and visual storytelling at the University of Southern California, Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism. She joins Katie and myself on the phone from San Diego. She's also host of Hard Money. So, Natalie, good to have you here with Katie and myself. Talk to us a little bit about, you know, Katie was talking about Ether and Ethereum. We follow the crypto markets on a regular basis. What's top of mind for you?
Hi, well, thank you so much for having me. Top of mind always for me is Bitcoin and making sure I can educate as many people as I can about the power of this rising computer network and the savings technology potential in a world where you can look at, you know, consumer spending and savings. Spending is in an all-time high when it comes to credit, and savings at an all-time low. And we really need a form of money that can't be manipulated. It can't be inflated the way that our current monetary system works. And so I'm very passionate about Bitcoin. And so I've been happy about the recent rally. You know, it shot up about 20% in July, but I still think that there's going to be more choppiness, volatility, and pain ahead as the Fed tries to aggressively, you know, hike rates and fight inflation. So I don't see us reaching our all-time highs anytime soon, but I do think it's the best long-term bet that we have out there.
Why do you think that? Because, I mean, I really enjoy following the crypto markets. I speak to a lot of people within the crypto industry, but I feel like Bitcoin has kind of lost its narrative in terms of it being an inflation hedge, it being a store of value. I'm wondering what you see is very exciting about this moment.
Yeah, so two things I'll say about that. As far as the inflation hedge, you really have to step back and think about the time frame you're examining Bitcoin from, because over the last 10 years, it's outperformed every stock index, it's outperformed precious metals, gold, and really outperformed real estate as well. So it's pretty much been the best performing asset as it grows in adoption and awareness. So in the short time frame when everything's falling, we have major stocks falling, indices falling, real estate now finally drawing.
All right, I got to jump in because stocks have actually bounced back. And I think many would say, including a lot of people, you know, within the crypto industry, that we are so early in on this, that it's like the very, very early days of the internet. So I feel like when we talk about, you know, investors getting involved in this, we have to be cautious.
That's why we recommend something called dollar cost averaging, right? We don't want people to sit there and risk their entire life savings on something that they're not familiar with. Bitcoin requires a lot of study, and it's difficult to explain it in a soundbite, but what it's trying to ultimately fix is what is broken in the monetary system, this manipulation of money that leads to capital being allocated really to the people at the top at the expense of everybody else, the money printing, the fact that we are so far in debt and we have no alternative other than Bitcoin that can solve a lot of these issues. So if you think that there's even a 1-5% chance that Bitcoin could become an asset that overtakes, say, a $10 trillion market cap like gold or even more, then it's something that you might think about allocating 1-5% of your portfolio to. This isn't something
that... is it Fidelity that would like to help you with that?
Natalie, we don't have much time left, so I want to jump in and ask, why Bitcoin? Because if we further this internet sort of tech boom of the early 2000s metaphor, there was Amazon and there was pets.com. So why Bitcoin when you look across the entire landscape of all the different coins and tokens out there?
Sure. So Bitcoin is the decentralized, secure, and scalable blockchain. Whereas things that you mentioned, Amazon, pets.com, ultimately those are centralized forces. Bitcoin is like the internet. It's a protocol. It's in the same way, I believe it's going to be as revolutionary in terms of freedom and the ability to gain prosperity as the internet was. You can send value from one part of the world to another. It settles almost instantly with no third party. And it gives access to 8 billion people to have a form of digital property.
But why couldn't that be Ether or Solana, for example?
Well, so there are a lot of questions that remain as far as the long-term consensus model in terms of how are these tokens going to be released? What is going to be the supply? What are the rules surrounding that? There are so many unanswered questions, whereas Bitcoin has been proven for the last 13 years to be a decentralized and secure network that is secured by energy. And the difficulty adjustment, the brilliancy of the programming that Satoshi invented, it has never been hacked. And it is the one form of, I would say, you know, hard money that comes in a digital format that people can start to allocate their savings to and watch it grow over time.
Right. Well, I feel like this is a conversation we'll continue to have certainly for a long time. Natalie Brunell, thank you so much. Adjunct professor over at University of Southern California, host of Hard Money.
This episode is brought to you by EY. How can EY teams help you create a better version of your company? We work with you to turn data into greater insights, invest to drive growth, and realize your strategic vision through thoughtful implementation. Visit ey.com/reimagine to learn more.
Success is more than the final destination. It's a path you take one step at a time. It's discipline. It's teamwork. And it's the drive and passion inside of us that comes before all recognition. It's what Stifel's been doing for over 130 years. Quietly, yet strategically, Stifel's become one of the fastest growing wealth management and investment banking firms in the country. Our financial advisors go beyond traditional wealth management to provide clients with direct access to one of the industry's largest equity research franchises and a leading middle market investment bank. Because success is the drive it takes to keep climbing. The passion to keep investing, the best of each of us made better by the best in all of us. And that is where success meets success. Start your journey at Stifel.com. That's Stifel.com.
Stifel Nicholas and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
I'm driving in my car. I turn on the radio.
How about you let me drive?
Oh, no.
Who's gonna drive you home?
Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive on.
Excuse me, I wanna drive.
It's the question that drives us.
This is the Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
All right, everybody, just about 10 and a half minutes left in today's trading session. We are getting ready to wrap up the trading day and the trading week. A lot of news coming out of certainly Washington. Continue to track the unsealing, or it looks like the release of that warrant that led to the search, the FBI search of former President Donald Trump's home. So we'll continue to track that. In the meantime, the markets, we've really seen a risk trade on. So great to have back with us once again, Doug Ramsey, Chief Investment Officer of the Luthel Group. His core investment fund up about 4% in the past month, up nearly 6% on average annually over the past 5 years. He's based in Minneapolis and he joins us on the phone from there. Doug, good to have you here with us. I do want to talk markets. That's your world. But I got to ask you, all this news regarding the FBI search of former President Donald's home in Florida, the investigations, how does political news or the upcoming midterms factor into your thinking about investment strategy, if at all?
Well, from time to time, political developments can influence our analysis. And I think to use the president in question, I mean, the Trump bump back in the fall of 2016 upon his election was incredible. The bounce in business confidence associated with, I think, more so pro-business rhetoric, maybe in some cases, than policy. It was enormous. As I recall, the Russell 2000 was up about 22% in a month following that election, and it really did usher in sort of a new phase of, you know, what had been a pretty slow economic expansion. Mm-hmm. So that's, you know, one very clear example in my career that I can think of. But something like this is just a little bit more noisy. Now, in terms of the midterm year, there is a very strong historical tendency for midterm years to be difficult, and this year's been no exception. And especially like the middle 6 months of a midterm year have been host to just, I mean, a statistically out-of-line number of major market lows. Now, the good news is, and again, and this is a pattern I've seen throughout my career, beginning right around that midterm election time in early November, you flip from a very negative historical pattern to a very positive one. So who knows, you know, maybe markets get smarter over time and maybe they're anticipating that strong seasonal pattern that's due to arrive later this year.
Well, tell us a little bit about that strong seasonal pattern, because as you know, probably better than most, it's been a pretty rocky, volatile year so far for the S&P 500 and most financial asset classes.
It has been, and I think, you know, the Fed policy turn, along with maybe the fiscal policy turn that's been unappreciated, to swing from, I think, you know, at the extreme in 2020, we had a deficit that was close to 20% of GDP, and it's now down to a little over 4%. So the delta, not just in monetary policy, but in fiscal policy this year is enormous. And, you know, I am impressed with the way that, you know, after sliding through the first 5 months of the year, we've had this impressive bounce back. Now, that being said, I mean, if we close where we are, well, it's only 5 minutes, so I bet pretty heavily on that.
Right.
We'll be up about 16.5% here. The average bear market rally of any bear market that's had one, not all bear markets even have a bear market rally, but the average bear market rally of more than 10% has been 15.5% unfolding in 40 trading days. Well, this one is about 16.5% in 39 trading days. So you're right on the average.
So we're done?
Well, I don't know. This one's been very impressive, and you know, we are certainly one to look at what the charts are doing. And I think at today's close, you know, it'll take a while to get these numbers, but I think we look at three bread thrust measures that we've done a lot of work on and have come to trust. I think at least one of those is going to trigger with today's action, which is provocative because these signals are almost never seen during an ongoing bear market. So in terms of magnitude, you know, we've seen these bear market rallies of this size and length before, but in terms of its internal strength, this one is standing out.
Mm. So bear market rally, no new bull market, or or continuation with the pandemic being
thinking.
A major blip.
Well, because we run longs and shorts in our tactical fund, we have, I mean, our net equity exposure, we've let it right up alongside this rally. I mean, that being said, we're still pretty defensive at 45-46% net equity exposure. But it's been powerful enough that we've decided just to let it ride. And I'm still not inclined, even though I do think ultimately this is a cyclical bear market that's got further room to run. You know, maybe we'll hold off on trimming equity exposure yet for a few more weeks, just given the power of this thing. And it really gets back to the likelihood that policy remains tight, even with inflation very likely to have peaked.
Well, Doug, take this a little bit cross-asset for us and wrap in the yield curve, which, of course, the 2s-10s yield curve deeply inverted at this point. Mm-hmm. We only have about 40 seconds, but what is the signal there?
It's an early pre-recession signal. What we've found in terms of economic forecasting is that using a shorter-term yield like the 3-month rather than the 2-year and comparing that to the 10-year, that spread, the 10-year minus 3-month, is a much better economic forecaster. So we haven't seen that invert yet. It's gotten close, but to us that's really when the recession countdown would begin. And then there's usually a lag time between that inversion in the 10 versus 3 month and the actual recession. So this could be an opportunity for someone who's very fleet-footed and maybe has more risk tolerance than we do on our core fund to chase this for a while. But again, that's not my recommendation, but it is possible.
All right, we got to run. Hey, listen, Doug, have a great weekend. Doug Ramsey, Chief Investment Officer of the Luthold Group.
Thanks for listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Download the podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
And you can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News.
Osage County, Oklahoma is getting a lot of attention right now. It's the setting of Martin Scorsese's latest film, Killers of the Flower Moon. The movie is based on a book about the 1920s Osage murders, when white men poured into Osage County and killed Osage people for their oil wealth. I'm Rachel Adams Hurd, the host of In Trust, a podcast from Bloomberg and iHeartMedia. For over a year, I was reporting a different story about other ways white people got Osage land and wealth, and how a prominent ranching family in Osage County became one of the biggest landowners here. Their ranching empire was built on land that at the turn of the century was all owned by the Osage Nation. So how'd they get it? Listen to the award-winning podcast In Trust on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.